The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So historically, Buddhism was not called Buddhism. It's a kind of a modern Western name that came up maybe in the 1800s. More often in Asia, in places like India and Sri Lanka, and Buddhism was called a magga or marga, a path. And it's one of the salient features of Buddhist practice. It involves walking a path, following a path. And most simplistically, it's a path to freedom, freedom from suffering. And we start where we're at, with the challenges of our lives, our suffering we have, and we engage in the path that moves us towards something quite phenomenal, which is the profound peace that comes with the liberation from suffering, from the forces of suffering inside of us. Another word that's related to path is journey. And I prefer the word journey, that as we engage in practice, in mindfulness practice, we're engaged in a journey. And part of the reason I like journey is that journey is something you do personally. A path, you know, can be out there, and you know about it, but it has no personal role in your life. Other people can walk the path. But a journey is something that's personal, something that describes an engagement in traveling along a path, along a trip. And it's a very personal word, partly because the word comes from the French word day, and apparently it originally meant however far you traveled in a single day. So each person's journey is complete at the end of the day, because each person travels a different distance because they traveled how far they go. So it has this kind of personal quality to it. Also, I think the word journey, I don't know how, for me at least, the connotations, a little bit has to do with an adventure. You go on a journey, and it's the process of the travels which is part of what's important, not just where you're going to go, where you're going to get to. So the process of the journey. And so I think of this mindfulness practice as a journey that we undertake. And it's a journey that where we always start here. And a lot of it is learning how to be here. And we start here, where we're at, and it's a journey that takes us to here. But when we come here, again, where we've always been, it's so poignant or so powerful or so significant that perhaps we could use the spell the word with a capital H, here. It's such a significant thing to really be here. And the journey, the adventure to arrive really here in a way that's profoundly significant, profoundly spiritually liberating, involves a lot of lessons, a lot of changes in our hearts and minds. It certainly involves learning the value, appreciating the value of being here as opposed to being there and then. And a lot of the distractions we have a lot to do with there and then. The ideas in the past, the stories, the memories, the resentments, the hopes for the futures, the fears of the future, fantasies we have. And so it's a journey to learn how to let go of what Buddhism would call then distractions, the strong compulsive ways in which we go into the mind, into our thoughts, and live somewhere, anywhere but here and now. It's also a deep encounter as we really hear and beginning to kind of wake up, be mindful of what's here. There has to be some degree of courage, some degree of willingness to be here. And this idea of willingness to be here, when here is difficult and challenging, is part of the adventure, part of the journey. And it's difficult to be here sometimes for many reasons. Our lives are difficult, and so we have to somehow feel and experience our lives have an impact on us and our emotions and our feelings and our thoughts. And so those have to be processed and seen and addressed. Also, there are past experiences in our life, the ways we grew up, the ways that things that we experienced that maybe are never quite resolved or never quite finished growing up out of. And so to really be here in a grown-up way, we have to really kind of see the unresolved issues, the incomplete ways in which we haven't grown. And we have to kind of address it and deal with it. And it's not easy to do that. And if we don't do it, then the inner pain, the inner struggles, the inner challenges we have, there can be very powerful forces to recoil from it and pull back from it. Anywhere but here, please. And so to learn how to be here, even when it's challenging, is important. And to learn to be able to recognize the preciousness of here, the value, the treasures of being really here, and how some of these amazing inner treasures of heart, of mind, are perhaps a greater form of wealth and treasure than external treasure, the kind of things we chase in the outer world. And how to really understand and appreciate that this inner wealth has tremendous value. And in fact, its value is greater than some of the things we chase after. So it's a process of learning, and eventually we hopefully learn to be here in such a way that it's one of the most valuable places to be, something that our life is enhanced by, bigger because we're here. And of course in Buddhism, as we get more and more here, there's a wonderful thing that here disappears, and now disappears. But not because we've left it to go back to the past or the future, or left it to go other places, but because we're so deeply settled here that all these concepts and ideas that we tend to swim in and make up and organize our life with, for temporarily can just settle away and relax. And the deeper kind of wellsprings of peace and well-being don't require concepts of here and now. Don't require concepts of me, myself, and mine. Don't require concepts of me and the other person. And at least for brief periods of time, all these things fall away to really be here. So a journey from here to here. So there's a couple of stories I want to tell you from the Buddhist tradition that kind of present the idea of a journey a little bit. And the first one both of them are from ancient Mahayana Buddhist sutras, sutras from a different Buddhist tradition than what we practice here. So you might not have encountered them. And the first one is maybe a little bit magical, so a teeny bit. So there was a young person who grew up in a village and decided upon becoming an adult to young adult, to go travel around the world and see the world. And the last night the person was in the village sleeping, someone came along and sewed a very valuable, expensive jewel in the lining of the person's coat. Person got up in the morning, put on the coat, didn't know about the jewel, and set forth out into the world. And the person traveled and on the journey for many, many years. Whatever money and means the person had was used up after some time, and the person eventually lost track of the way home and where the person was and ended up in poverty and misery, begging and stumbling along. And in the wanderings around as a poor pauper and confused and lost, it just so happened that one day the person wandered into the home village. And the people, "Oh, so happy to see you. Welcome back. And so how were you? Oh, it's been hard. I've been so poor and hungry and a lot of challenges. But didn't you realize that right there in the lining of your jacket was this really expensive jewel?" "No." "You didn't tell me." And so this little parable or fable or something points to the idea that we have in the linings of our heart, perhaps, a jewel, but we don't know about it. And because we don't know about it, we can wander around lost in the world and think we're quite poor, begging for not maybe money and food, but begging for love and belonging and all kinds of things. We're kind of looking for something, but we have all we need here that we can be successful. And why it's a bit magical, this story, is that it points to like a singular solution. You know, if you just can discover what that jewel is inside, you'll be happier ever after. You know, and so just point, tell me where the jewel is, you know, and so I can get on with it. And so, but it's a nice story, this idea that, you know, there's something inside. So the second story is also of a young person who goes off into the world to see what's there, travels for many years, and also runs into the same kind of, you know, fate where poverty, lost, and a difficult time, perhaps as a pauper wandering around, dirty and hungry, and you know, sometimes people don't treat people like that well, and they're outcasts, and people throw rocks at them and leave our village. We don't want you here, and person kind of ended up, kind of, after a while, even forgetting where home was, and even forgetting family name and the given name. And personal identity can be a little bit maybe deranged. But as it happens, the person eventually wandered around and ended up back home and was walking down the street past the parents' homes and the childhood home. And it turned out it was a mansion. It's kind of wealthy place with big gardens and barns with horses and lots of wealth. And one of the parents saw the person walking down the street and said, "Oh, that person doesn't remember me or where the home is. And seems a bit deranged." So it went up to the child and said hello. And it was obvious the child not only didn't know who the parent was, but didn't really know that it was the child of that parent, that that home was the mansion and the wealthy place. So the parent had said, "Well, I think I need to do this as a process here." So the parent first said, "You know, I see that you're hungry and poor, and I bet you could use some food. I have a barn that's full of horse manure." Maybe I should say horse shit, for the sake of the story. Why don't you come, and if you can shovel some of that, then I'll feed you." And that made sense. So the person shoveled shit for a while, and then eventually, you know, after a few hours, got a meal. And the parent said, "Would you like to become the regular, poop shoveler? You know, we need them here." And, "Okay, yes." And so the person had a little room in the back of the barn, and every day would shovel. And the person was pretty diligent and worked hard. So after a while, the parent said, "You know, you work hard at this shoveling. What do you think of a little promotion? Why don't you come and be a gardener, work in the garden? And you can dig and plant." And so the person said, "Okay, I can do that. I can learn maybe how to do the garden after all the shoveling in the barn." And so the person went to the garden, started to shovel, and the head gardener taught them the art and craft of gardening. After a while, became a pretty good gardener and had started to have confidence that he, she, they could do kind of the gardening, had a task. And then the parent said, "Hey, you're doing this pretty well. Why don't you come into the house? I need an attendant." And so became the personal attendant and took care of all kinds of household and things and all kinds of things, and started feeling comfortable and confident living in the house. Didn't feel like an outcast, and felt like it has a sense of purpose in life and value and belonging. And then the parent said, "Well, now you're doing so well. Why don't you become in charge of my treasury, all my money, and you can do that, I'm sure." So the person did that, and confidence and sense of belonging and integrity and all that, and it was great. And pretty soon it was kind of almost like, ran the household, ran everything, and felt confident and able to do that. And then, at some point, near the old age of the parent said, oh, and by the way, you're actually our child. This is your rightful inheritance, this place. But you were so deranged and had so little confidence in yourself, so little belief in yourself, that it probably would have given you a heart attack if I told you, or if I told you, you would have run away, not believing it. It just wouldn't have made it computed for you. And you needed to slowly gain confidence and a sense of competency to eventually be able to hear the good news of your rightful place, where you were born, who you really are. So this is also kind of a parable, like kind of a fable. But here, not, you know, magic, just realize you have a jewel, but it's a journey, a process by which the person slowly came to realize and understand what was always true. The jewel was always there, in a sense, but it took a long time to learn that that's the case, and the person to kind of step into that role of, you know, of being an autonomous, powerful, significant person, to discover the inner wealth, not just the outer wealth of the mansion. And so we all have this as the story, the idea of the story, but it takes not so easy to discover it. And so this journey is partly to be here, to arrive really here for the first time, is also a journey of rediscovery, of discovering something about ourselves. And whether we already have a rightful place, you know, we already are the child of the Buddha in a sense, we just have to realize it, or whether it's something that we develop over time and we grow into it, even if we didn't originally have that identity, that's kind of, you know, a philosophical question that we don't have to deal with. But it's still a journey to discover something here, a way to be here. And Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on the idea of a journey or a path, and I think it does a lot of respect to what now in modern world we think of developmental models of personal growth. And I think a lot of this idea that humans develop, have a developmental stage as they go through, arose out of studies of developments of childhood, psychological growth during childhood. And people like Piaget showed very distinct stages that children go through if everything goes along healthily, appropriately. And people have also taken these ideas and tried to discern them in their people's religious life as well. And there's a scholar named James Fowler who came up with he called them stages of faith, that the way people grow in religiosity goes through stages as well. And it's interesting, you know, not everyone agrees with his stages, but it's a journey, it's a path of personal growth and development. And part of what this journey from here to here entails is sometimes completing the psychological development that maybe got thwarted as a children or wasn't completed. Or the parts that, part of his stages are not just, for James Fowler, are not just about childhood stages, but also into adulthood. And so, you know, the psychological development of human beings, the maturation, is not only a childhood issue, but also we go through developmental stages as adults as well. If everything goes along well, if we don't get stay frozen in one particular stage. And so this idea of progressive development and growth is the model that Buddhism has. In fact, it's so important, this idea, that in some schools of Buddhism, they say that the real development, the real stages of growth, happen after your first experience of awakening. Some people are looking up at awakening. I want that. And everything's going to be happy ever after that. But in some schools, it's once you have that first taste of awakening, then you know what it's really about. So now you can start your growth. I don't know if that's encouraging or discouraging. And some of these developmental models that of human growth, of childhood growth, that apply them to religious life, start with some of the first stages, and Fowler talks about the first 2 years of life, that's where we learn whether to feel safe and to trust this world that we live in, this universe that we live in. And many people, and it really comes from, a lot of it has to do with how our parental experiences look like, that we have parents who provide safety and security and they're there for us. And there are people who don't have that. And as a teacher, talking to people about their personal lives, I hear amazing stories of people who, really attribute their sense of lack of safety, lack of trust in this world, feeling of fear and not belonging, to how they were received by their parents when they were born. Or some people even talk about, my mom told me that she was really clear when she was pregnant. She didn't want me. I was an obstacle, and she kept telling me growing up that I was just an obstacle for her, and she basically ignored me. One person told me recently that to this very day, the person was probably in his 50s or 60s now, the person who told me, they said, to this day, if you met my mother, you wouldn't have no evidence that she cares about me at all. So that, it started quite young. And some people have, received this kind of basic nurturance and sense of safety. And so part of this journey to hear and practice for people who, at this very early stage of life, didn't get that message, didn't get that kind of conditioning, is to recondition ourselves. And it's a powerful thing to be able to meet this core sense of lack of safety, that lack of basic trust, and work with it and feel it and slowly learn to have a reconditioning. And part of the value of meditation, if once we can kind of settle deeply into it, not easy to do, is that the sense of unification, the sense of wholeness and well-being that come from meditation, is a kind of conditioning or kind of atmosphere that penetrates deep down into the marrow of our bones, into our cells, or into deep into the psychology of our mind. And there's some possibility of doing some kind of reconditioning, redoing of this basic trust when it hasn't been created early in life. And so Fowler said that set in place the first couple of years of your life. And I found parenting quite difficult at times, but I take some solace in the fact that I think those first 2 years were okay. So the foundation is there. So then the next stage that Fowler talks about is just speaking, learning a language. Is it we don't just learn a language, but we learn ways of thinking. We learn concepts and ideas and images in which to organize our life. And some of those are religious. And so some people learn religious concepts and ideas as they learn language. And so sometimes the belief system then is so deeply embedded in the kind of linguistic mind that it's very hard to see the world without the lens of the particular religious worldview that you grew up in. And so that's kind of an acquisition of ideas and concepts. And when we do meditation practice, sometimes that's quite challenging also, because at least in Buddhist meditation, to go really deep into here in a deep way that there's at the right time, there is also a dropping of all concepts. And it can be quite frightening for people who don't have basic trust to start seeing the world without some of these core, deeply embedded linguistic structures in their mind, that's how they find their way in the world. That's what makes them safe in the world, or how they understand their world. And so, that has to be kind of some point addressed. And then the next stage for Fowler is that with these concepts and ideas we have, young children will have a kind of anthropocentric kind of idea of the world, that the world is kind of like people, and there's agency in the world, and there's fixed ideas of what makes order in the world, and justice and fairness. And it's a little bit magical thinking. I remember when I was about 5 or 6, I had this kind of thinking where It was 4th of July, and I brought home a long like branch or stick or pole. And there was, in the back of the apartment complex where we lived, there was a the 4th of July party, and there was a picket fence. And I kind of brought this big pole or stick and put it next to the picket fence. And then there was an older, probably a teenage boy, he seemed like pretty big to me, and who picked up that pole and then tried to pole vault over that picket fence. And the process of doing, as I remember it, tripped on the fence and broke his leg. I was responsible. So this idea of assigning responsibility, because I brought the pole back. So this strong sense of responsibility of who's in charge and who did something is sometimes kind of a very clear kind of thinking. It could make order, make sense of things. Sometimes arises at this age. And that's something they say that in later stages people begin to grow out of if the developmental process proceeds. But that if it doesn't evolve out of there, then people can stay in very strong dichotomous thinking, right and wrong thinking, right up into adulthood and so forth. And often it comes along with assigning of blame. Other people are responsible. Other people are supposed to make things better. The world is supposed to provide in some fixed way. And sometimes there's not so much of looking at personal responsibility. And then, these are very vague stages, and we shouldn't take them as being dogmatically true, but it kind of points to some kind of trajectory, perhaps, that some of us can recognize. And then there's stages of identity, acquisition of identity, that seems to be kind of clearly important task around the age of 12 or 13, according to Fowler. And so sense of belonging, having a place in the world, being someone in the world. And so here, in terms of religion, people then can develop very strong identification with their religion at this age. And what he says is that the identification and engagement in their religion and belonging, they tend to ignore what they don't like or what seems wrong or what they don't believe in. They suspend their critical thinking in favor of just belonging and being part of this identity, of this religious identity. But then a little bit later, in teenagehood or young adulthood, then there comes a stage where people are willing to question their beliefs and look at some of the contradictions, look at some of the challenges they have, and to stop looking so much as to have an identity by acquiring or taking something from outside. I belong to this religion, I'm a Buddhist, that's who I am. But rather to start looking, taking responsibility for their feelings, take responsibility for their thoughts and beliefs for themselves, rather than having them given to them and adopting what's given to them from the society around them. So a period of questioning and exploring and personal responsibility becomes very important in this stage. And then he goes on and says, Fowler says, that after this kind of questioning and beginning to take personal responsibility for one's own beliefs, there tends to be an ability to transcend beliefs and not see the world only through belief systems. Those people have those beliefs, I have my beliefs, this is what I've come to. But maybe to see a little bit the relative nature of some of these beliefs or the paradox in beliefs, and understand how people have ideas and concepts and ideas to organize their lives, but perhaps they're not ultimate, but maybe there's a kind of way of harmonizing them and not kind of be for and against. And the story that I've told maybe too many times here that maybe points a little bit to this is when I was living in a Japanese Zen monastery in Japan and learning Japanese, learning to live with, I was the only non-Japanese person living there. And Japanese culture is very different from American culture. And so, not only learning a language, but slowly learning what wasn't being taught to me, explicitly. learning a whole different cultural way of being or worldview. And so every morning we would clean, had a 20-minute cleaning period, where all these, most of the monks were, 21, 22, so strong and vigorous. And you had to do everything fast and strong. And it was called Zen power, was called. One-pointed, fully engaged. And so everyone had these cloths and brooms and stuff. We were all cleaning and doing. And the, one of the common places I had to clean was the big kind of hall of worship, the ceremonial hall. It had pillars. And the important thing was to clean. It didn't matter if it was clean already. You just had to, so we had this phenomena that we would, I would clean a pillar, and someone would come right after me and clean the pillar, and I'd go find another pillar. Someone had, was not had already been cleaned, but it was no one was there, so I'd clean that pillar. So we just had to be cleaning, right? So it was vigorous, this whole dance, moving around. And then one day, I had this experience of kind of a waking up. And it's the best way I can describe it. Suddenly I realized that I was living in a different social universe than the Japanese monks I was living with. And so I don't know if I can describe it so exactly how it is, but I was an individual working together in a group of other individuals. They were a collective, first and foremost, a group, first and foremost, that had individuals who were participating in the group. Something like that. So their starting point was they saw themselves as an organism, kind of, as a collective, maybe, if, for the purposes of trying to explain this. And I had no idea. I mean, I had no background to let me see this kind of way of being in the world. I kind of assumed that they were just like me. Until I kind of realized, wait a minute, they're here very different, in the world very different than everyone than how I am. So that was a kind of part of the part of the story, and here's the point I wanted to make. And that is, when I saw that, I did not think that one way was better than the other, or one way was more right than the other. I thought different, as human beings find their way and organize themselves as in societies, that they have to kind of have some worldview about how they are together. And there are different choices that different societies make. And that's how they manage to get along and to do what they need to do. And so this is just one way, the Japanese, the strong individualism that I grew up with, is another way. They both have strengths and weaknesses, but I'm not going to hold one as being the best or the right one. They're appropriate in their own way. And so my job is to harmonize or understand or participate the best I can, depending where I was. So this is an example where rather than taking some dogmatic view of what's right, to appreciate that at some point a kind of transcendence or overview of ideas, and not to hold on to ideas as being the thing, but see them as relevant, relative or contingent, and then find a way to kind of transcend them and have a larger view. And then for James Fowler, that sets the stage for his final stage of faith. And the one that's most controversial in terms of other people, see his points of view. But this is this kind of transcendent of particular views and ideas of what's right and wrong allows people then to have universal compassion. It allows people to see a kind of universal quality of human beings, so that it allows to see that the compassionate impulse to cherish and value others takes precedence in a sense of a compassionate world that we live in. So I'm not presenting these ideas of Fowler as being definitive, like the right way, right? That would go against his sixth stage. But rather to point to this idea of a journey, that once we sit down to be here in mindfulness, to really start being willing to be present for our experience, what we run into over time are the forces inside of us, the momentum, the movements of the mind inside of us that are most active at different times, that are important for us. As, for example, if the mind gets quieter and quieter, it kind of like goes through layers in the mind. And some of the quiet underlying layers are, we peel away the skins of the onion. We run into some of the stages we're at. We run into some of the hindrances, some of the distractions, some of the compulsions, some of the needs, some of the unresolved issues. We run into the places where the developmental growth, the momentum of growth that's within us is trying to push up and move forward. But, you know, it's been buried for so long. But then as it gets released, then there's this movement, you know, like, oh, some people sometimes see it as a yearning or as a expression or as a, you know, as a need or different things. And, you know, and sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's subconscious, this that goes on. And but there's a powerful process of being here, being present and then mindful here, being aware here, that over time you'll get what you're supposed to get. In fact, if you do a path of mindfulness and do it well, there are no mistakes in terms of what bubbles up and arises from inside of you. Whatever it is that you sit quietly, like for example with your eyes closed and meditating mindfully, whatever wells up inside of you is perfect for you. It's just what the doctor ordered. It's just like this is your next stage. This is what you need to address. This is what needs to be met with. And if some of these early childhood experiences are kind of need to be healed or need to be kind of completed, sometimes it's very hard to do it alone. Sometimes we really need to have community. Sometimes we need to have teachers or maybe therapists or different kind of elders, you know, in our lives that can kind of help us, support us, and hold our hands and guide us and make it easier, more possible to do it. And in Buddhism, this journey from here to here, it can sound pretty, just to say, from here to here, I mean, you know, like, gee, like, why bother? You know, I'm already here. You know. But I think it's one of the most significant things we can do to mature and to grow. This thing about going from here to here is quite a powerful thing. It's quite a significant thing. It's probably one of the great great journeys of a lifetime to do this. And I hope that a little bit of how I've presented it today can give you a little bit of sense of how significant it is to go nowhere. But to go here, to be here in a full way. And in doing that, to arrive where you've always been in a new way. To arrive where you've always been, and here becomes your treasure. Here becomes your kingdom, your mansion, your paradise. Here becomes the place where who you are, where your good heart can become a gift for the world around you. Because in the end, entering into the world with gift-bestowing hands is one of the great tasks of any human life. Thank you.